Sitting Bull requested this council. We await his words.
Take your soldiers out of here. They scare the game away.
Very well, sir. Tell me then, how far away should I take my men?
You must take them out of our lands.
What precisely are your lands?
These are the lands where my people lived before you whites first came.
I don't understand. We whites were not your first enemies. Why don't you demand back the land in Minnesota, where the Chippewa and others forced you from years before?
The Black Hills are sacred land given to my people by Wahantonka.
Not very convenient to cloak your claims in spiritualism. And what would you say to the Mormons and others who believe that their God has given to them Indian lands in the West?
I would say they should listen to Wahantonka.
No matter what your legends say, you didn't sprout from the plains like the spring grasses. And you didn't coalesce out of the ether. You came out of the Minnesota woodlands, armed to the teeth, and set upon your fellow man. You massacred the Kiowa, the Omaha, the Ponca, the Oto, and the Pawnee without mercy. And yet you claim the Black Hills as a private preserve bequeathed to you by the Great Spirit.
And who gave us the guns and powder to kill our enemies? And who traded weapons to the Chippewa and others who drove us from our home?
Chief Sitting Bull, the proposition that you were a peaceable people before the appearance of the white man is the most fanciful legend of all. You were killing each other for hundreds of moons before the first white stepped foot on this continent. You conquered those tribes, lusting for their game and their lands, just as we have now conquered you for no less noble a cause.
This is your story of my people.
This is the truth, not legend.
Welcome back to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have David Wimhoff back on the show. Of course, David is an attorney and the author of John Courtney Murray, Time Life, and the American Proposition, which is now available in its second edition, also in digital form. I have both formats. His website is The American Proposition. David, how are you doing this evening?
Pretty good, Tim. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you for coming back on. Well, you have a couple of these articles. I think one is not yet published.
Yeah, there's a couple of things that have been going on that I've been observing lately. I think a lot of other people have been observing it, okay, too. And that's just kind of what prompted some thinking and some research along these lines. First of all, this summer we had Patrick Deneen's book come out, Regime Change.
Yes.
And I don't know if you had other guests talk about it or not, but it is a notable work in the sense that it identifies the need to change regimes, and it identifies the regimes as being the socioeconomic elites. I think that is a very valuable service he's provided. I think we can argue about how he's going to do that, because he seems to be trying to refurbish the federalist system and try to give it another shot in the arm. He comes up with some good suggestions to break up the power and the wealth of these elites, to look at expanding the House of Representatives, which is a change of Title II U.S. Code 2A. And he talks about some other things about national service and stuff like that. I think that where probably he may fall down on one important area is that you need to make a fundamental change in the fundamental law of the land. And I think that you have to make sure that that change is something everybody respects and honors about how things are to be right ordered. Now, of course, I'll always tell you that you have to have the divine positive law, but there are also certain things that the natural law has to be respected. And one of the best ways the natural law comes out is through nations, this idea of nations, which the Catholic Church has always talked about over the years. There are things called nations or peoples. If you go to the Bible and you type in nation, you'll get about 677 different returns on the word nation. And it's a group of people. And they exist for a certain purpose. They exist for a certain reason. And that has to be kept in mind. Now, there's a definition to that. And I'm reading from a book called The Catholic Tradition of the Law of Nations by John Epstein. Epstein wrote this book in 1935. It received Neil Obstein Imprimatur. Very important book because it took a look at the Catholic Church's way of looking at the world and ordering the world. And it bases this ordering on the right ordering of the family, because the person has to be properly developed and the family is essential to that. But once again, this body of teaching is known as law of nations. So nations are very important. So Epstein writes, nation implies a people united by ties and traditions that come by birth, inherited character, customs, and language, constituting so coherent and powerful a culture that they can not only be passed from generation to generation, but can attract and assimilate other families and individuals. Such are the dominant notes of the nation, he writes. And then what he also says is, he says they come about, he says that they come about from a variety of different factors. They come about from human will. They come about by certain economic necessities, strategic factors, rivers, mountains, fertility of this land or another, and also to, you know, common language, common history, common struggles, all of these things, and common ideology or common religion pulls people together into nations. Usually they are tied to grounds, pieces of ground. They're always tied to a piece of ground. And so that's where you have patriotism. Patriotism is this love of one's country. Because it gives birth to your nation, and it is here in this country that we actually deal with the world, and we get to know the world, and we are in this certain area, if you will, this certain space where we are in touch with other people who are like us. It's a human setting. It's a physical setting. It's the native land. And that's where man gets his conception of family, place, friends, neighbors, language, and traditions. So, you know, we've always had in this country is this ideology, but we've also always had nations in this country, and people don't want to recognize that. They want to think it's some sort of racial struggle. And definitely the plutocracy has put us at odds with each other racially, but we have nations, and these nations have got to be allowed to develop. They have to be allowed to get the resources that they need to develop and develop in peace. And that is what the state does. The state is there to make sure that order happens. The nations get what they need. They develop. They have peaceful relations with each other. They have culture. They have families. They have religion. And all of this is part of order and suppressing disorder. And if you look around the United States now, there's a lot of disorder. I guess what prompted me into this area was there were a couple things that happened. One was, you know, of course, the war in the Ukraine. And Michael Hudson, Professor Michael Hudson, wrote a book that he talks about this as being a clash of civilizations. And in the book, he mentions how the CIA goes into other countries and attacks ethnicities on a racial basis. So that kind of got my interest up. And there is a lot of concern. I hear it every day from people who are Americans, and they're worried. They are concerned for the future. They are concerned for their kids. They're concerned for themselves. And what I'm talking about here, when I say Americans, is I'm talking about, you know, white Christian people. Americans, I view as being a separate ethnic group. And I believe that there are many different subgroups of the Americans. But what you have is some general principles and ideas that infuse this group of people, values, characteristics, various forms of Christianity that infuse this group of people. There are other nations. There's the Black Nation, the African Americans, or Negro Nation, as they were called. And then you also have, you know, the Latins and other smaller groups that exist. So you have multiple ethnicities in the United States. And what you have is this conflict between these people as the resources, as I see, are slowly and gradually being withdrawn. They're being pulled out of the room. And that's causing a real problem.
Yes. When you talk about things like laws of nations, what makes an international order possible is domestic order. And domestic order requires stability within communities, such things like family, proper respect for authority, autonomy. None of these things, of course, are being respected by the ruling elite, the oligarchy. In fact, they've declared open warfare on not only on, you know, the sanctity of the family, but also reason and reality. You know, the whole transgender nonsense, the whole push towards sexual degeneracy that's being advocated or being promoted by the state. So we have a situation in the United States where the state is diametrically opposed to the very things you cite as being necessary to a well-ordered society.
Yes, and I think that these things, I think all of these things, beginning with the Everson case in 1947, where they separated church and state all the way down to the local level, were weapons.
How does that differ from the original idea of the First Amendment?
Well, what Everson did is it used substantive due process to apply the First Amendment, separation of church and state, all the way down to the local level. Previously, you didn't have that. Yeah, the states could kind of mix religion with what they did. Now, you know, a lot of people make an issue of the First Amendment being something that allowed the states to have their own state religions. Yeah, it did. In actuality, and for a period of time, but by the 1840s, all the state religions were effectively gone. Mm-hmm. And in the 160 years until Everson came about, 150 years until Everson came about, you didn't have a single new state establish a state religion, but you still have people at the local level practice, you know, their religion in public. And you have to remember that American society, for the most part, was white, okay, white and Christian. That is the American identity. I mean, we call, you know, people with U.S. citizenship, regardless of their ethnicity, we call them Americans. But there is an American ethnicity, and that's my position, that there is an American ethnicity, and we know them as white people, and white people are under attack. That American ethnicity is under attack. Now, the same tools that are being used to attack Americans are going to be turned on every other race, every other nation. Every other nation is going to be attacked the same way. So you've got things like Everson, you know, you've got the things like you mentioned, abortion, contraception, you've got same-sex marriage, you've got all that stuff, which is being targeted against people, not just not just Americans or white people, but also ultimately it's going to be targeted against blacks and against every other group that comes here. And it's being shipped around the world. And so these things destroy their weapons, and they destroy nations. This is the destruction of nations. And I think we were warned about that in many different areas by many different people. And that is going on apace now. And so I hear almost every other day, I hear Americans, I hear white people say to me, you know, we're scared for our kids because we don't know what's going on. Now, we know that the Supreme Court knocked down affirmative action with that case that came out in June, which came out, which was the Students for Fair Admissions against Harvard and University of North Carolina. We know that they did away with affirmative action, but Justice Roberts, you know, kind of gave them a way out, what they could, what the schools could put in their admission packets. But after that decision, there were a number of educators, a number of legislators who wrote the universities and said, look, you guys have got to stop what you're doing, and you need to start bringing people in who have the ability to do it. Okay. So what you have in that case is if you bring people into colleges with the ability, you know, to do the work, then what you're having actually is interrelations between people. Okay. You have something called sociability that is going on. And sociability is something the Catholic Church has always impressed upon as being necessary. You have to be able to have people of different nations in a society get along, but you don't put them at odds with each other. You have to develop them. And the reality is that the Black nation in this country was undergoing a great development from the time of the Civil War. Some aspects of the Black nation had not undergone that development, mainly the ones in the cities. But what you had was you had the Black schools, which Justice Sotomayor talks about. You have what they call HBCUs, the historically Black colleges and universities come about that advanced the education of Blacks, advanced their learning, their material development. And this was something that was pushed by the U.S. government. U.S. government has always, you know, looked at different nationalities and tried to develop them in one sense or another, and generally in a material sense. They haven't had the spiritual ability to do it because you have the separation of church and state at the very top, but they have tried to develop these people materially, whites, Blacks, materially. When they talk whites and Blacks, what they start doing is they pit us against each other, you know, on race. And there's much more than race involved here. There's nations. There's specific, unique groups of people here that are trying to work out a modus vivendi in society. And unfortunately, the plutocrats and the elites have put them at odds with each other, at war with each other, and they base it on racial grounds. And so we have this conflict. We have people who are scared. We have the corporations who are continuing to basically pit the races against everyone, the nations against everyone, and they're not expanding the economic pie, because what's happening is wealth is becoming more and more concentrated in society. And so we're left to fight over the crumbs. And this is not right order, okay? All the goods, all the wealth are supposed to reach everybody. So these huge profits that these individuals and these companies make are getting locked up with these individuals and these companies, and they're not being reinvested in the people. And this is kind of what I see was happening in the 30s and 40s in this country. There was starting to be this move by the elites to get some system in place by which they can lock up this wealth, and at the same time kind of put the nations at odds with each other and not grow the economic pie. And so they had to come up with various ideas by which to do this. And that's what I talk about, you know, in the articles. But this is, I believe, the issue that we are facing is the development of peoples. And that requires their material and spiritual development. The Catholic Church was always very good. It always ministered to Blacks and administered to whites. And Father Lafarge was one person who ministered. And he did that because Leo XIII, you know, said, hey, you know, we need to do this. We need to minister to Indians. We need to minister to Blacks. And, of course, minister to the Americans. And so this is what Father Lafarge and other people did. Now, he was a blue blood. And he had a very, you know, he was descended from Ben Franklin, Oliver Hazard Perry. You know, he ran around with the upper crust. He was with America Magazine. Those guys all ran around with the upper crust. And he's a Jesuit. So a lot of his ideas, while they dealt with this idea of the development of nations, he also cast it in this new term of interracial justice, where it deals with equality. And I believe the bigger picture, the picture of how societies are supposed to be ordered in accordance with the Catholic law of nations, was lost. And so what you had is you had this phrase that could now be used against white people, against Americans, saying, well, you're bad, you're keeping these people out. And this would create conflict. And this would also demoralize Americans. And so this is, I believe, the unfortunate aspect of what he did. This was at the same time that Gunnar Myrdal was writing. And the elites did not want, as a friend of mine says, an apartheid state. They did not want a broken up state. The reality is that there was a considerable amount of social peace, but like Father Lafarge noted, there was an economic lower class that was both white and black, that was both American and Negro. And he said this was the issue. And the idea was, as I read his biography, was to get economic activity going instead of concentrating the economic activity with the few. So this is the milieu of the 30s and 40s. And this is when Brown versus Board of Education entered the picture. And that decision, you know, struck down segregation in schools. And of course, it took other decisions to broaden that segregation. And there was resistance in the South. And a lot of information starting to come out now about Martin Luther King, how he was tracked, followed, may have been more with the FBI. He may have been not just monitored, but controlled, perhaps, by the FBI. But that evidence is starting to come out, and that information is starting to come to the fore. And so this period is undergoing a relook. And I think what we have to do as Catholics and as Americans, we have to get back to the fact that all of this morality, you know, whether it's contraception or abortion, whatever it is in the context of a nation, of a people on a piece of dirt. And oftentimes these just become abstractions, but these things are necessary for our people to survive and do well. I mean, what is, it's not Beowulf. What is the one very famous ballad about sexual immorality and among the hierarchy or among the people? Among the leaders in a society. And what that does is that creates disorder in the society. So you have to have a society which is rightly ordered, but you have to put it in the context of that nation, of that people. We are a people. And we are separate and distinct from other peoples of the world. We are separate. You know, there's the Black Nation, and Blacks will tell you they have a culture, they have their schools, they have their identity, and there's an American nation, an American identity, and that is very real, and that is something, unfortunately, which is lost on people who see only race, and unfortunately, they think that that everybody is the same and everything is alike, and that's not true. We are alike in several key areas. We are all people are alike. We're alike in our nature. Okay, we got a body and a soul, got an intellect, we've got free will. We're created by God. We have a common destination, right? And then we also do live on the same planet. Okay, so we have some commonalities there, but we have different nations. There are differences between these peoples who grew up in different areas with different literature, with different languages, with different challenges, with different religions, with different circumstances. And that is essential to understanding there are differences, because tied with this nation is culture, which is necessary for the development of the group and development of the personality so that the person can achieve maturity. And so there are different modes of expression of this culture. You know, there's physical, moral, literature, all sorts of things that this thing, gestures, idioms, stuff like that. But every culture is different. You know, American culture's got a lot of subcultures. They're different from Black culture. There are certain aspects and characteristics of Black culture that are different from American culture. But we still live in this country. The laws have still got to benefit, all the people. You can't deny one nation or another these essential rights, and these fundamental rights are set forth in the Catechism, section 2211, but they're also set forth elsewhere in Catholic writing. And these fundamental rights, you know, it's the right to have a family, to religion, to right culture, the right information, to an education, to economic opportunity. You know, you got to have that, to have economic means to do it. And I think that instead of socializing, you know, the downside of this, saying, oh, white people are bad, which is what we hear over and over again, we need to privatize the responsibility. And that means that the corporate leaders, the business leaders, the financial leaders have got to spread the wealth. They've got to open up opportunities for everybody, and they got to stop the concentration of wealth, because this is very, very unfortunate in that regard.
But if you distribute the wealth that way, how will Jeff Bezos be able to afford to build yachts that are too big to fit under bridges in Europe?
You know, I haven't thought about that. I better go back to the drawing board.
You must be a communist, David.
Well, I've been called a communist, but I'm not. I mean, the church, I just give them 2401 and 2403 and 2404. The church says all goods are bound to destination. I said, you have are bound to the human, to all humans. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the church says private property is fine. The church says, and it's okay. Private property is good. The right to make a profit is good. Okay. These things are good. The church recognizes this. This makes sense. This was the economic engine that made America and the American people so productive. Okay. It was capitalism, or a form of capitalism. There's this concept of, providential development. You know, God has given all of us, he said, you know, go forth, prosper, subdue the earth, and make it prosperous, okay? So this idea is something that the Americans have always dealt with from the very beginning, from colonial days. And as I have argued, much to the surprise of many people, there were a lot of factors that justified the American Revolution. And, you know, the big factor that justified it was just simply the fact that the people were being economically crushed. Now, some people prospered. I'm not going to deny that. But the economic growth, the ability to develop these, you know, the earth, the resources of the earth, whether it's farming, whether it's mining or manufacturing, whether it's trade, all these things the church sees as good, that ability was severely hampered by the British mercantilist system. And the British had very strict controls over trade. We didn't have currency over here. We had paper money, but that became a real problem. We couldn't create the specie that was necessary to pay the bills due the English. There was a demarcation point where Americans were not allowed to go west after the treaty with Pontiac in 1766. Mm-hmm. And you know, everybody gets upset about the Quebec Act. What the Quebec Act did was, it let the Canadians have Catholicism, right? Okay. But it also said the fur trade belonged to the Canadians. Well, that got a lot of Americans upset, okay? Because the Americans wanted to develop it. Now, the economic growth of the Americans was retarded, okay? And they had done enormous things in developing this land and being very creative and in creating things. Our forebears did a lot of incredible things. They were very practical people, and they made things happen. Okay. So this was a big motivation of the American Revolution. There may have been impure reasons, but those impure reasons do not invalidate the revolution. And you had a number of other issues with the colonies, you know, with multiple religions, and the founders trying to keep peace while at the same time implement a system that they had gotten basically from the ruling classes of England. Lord Ashford, Josiah Childs, and also John Locke. Lord Ashley, John Locke, they worked together. But this system they developed on how to become, how to make society profitable. And it was, you know, basically the liberal or the capitalist order. So this is what the American founders implemented. And then, you know, we moved west after the American Revolution. Now, you ran into a group of people called, you know, the Indians, right? And this is where Notre Dame comes in. And Notre Dame has got something called the Kroc Institute. The Kroc Institute bills itself as one of these places that wants to build world peace. And of course, one of the things that it puts out there on its webpage is a chest thumping that this is the homeland of ancestral lands of the Indians, the Potawatomi Indians. They say, we acknowledge the Kroc Institute's presence on the traditional homelands of Native peoples, particularly the Pokagon and Potawatomi, been using this land for thousands of years, continue to do so. Okay, we recognize our own place in the history and practices of colonialism and understand that our responsibilities extend beyond this gesture of land acknowledgement. We must also reflect on the University of Notre Dame's past, present, and future relationship with the original stewards of this land and actively pursue ways to amend this troubled relationship. Well, you know, that's an attack on Americans, okay? And what you have, even today, on NPR, there was an Indian tribe, a Sioux tribe in Minnesota, which was talking about how horrible the Americans were, and how the Indian, you know, his dolorous tone says they perpetrated a Holocaust against us and all of this evil. Well, what came out?
Hey, is Holocaust an Indian word?
I guess it's an Indian word now. They can now use it with a capital H, right?
With a capital H, okay.
Oh, it's small H. Yeah, right, small H. Yeah, all right, okay. Good one, Tim. So he said they perpetrated this Holocaust. So, okay, that's an attack on the American people. Okay, and you know, once again, I'm saying Americans are white and they're Christian. And we're of European descent. That's our ancestry. That's our identity. Is that race? Could be our heritage, too. Okay.
Now, what Holocaust did the Sioux perpetrate to gain control of the land?
Well, that one I don't quite know, because in the story that was on NPR, they were talking about how the Sioux Indians negotiated with the U.S. government to get a strip of sacred land 10 miles on either side of the Minnesota River running from point A to point B. And it was several million acres. And so this Indian says, yeah, we've negotiated that with the government. Well, that doesn't sound like a genocidal government to me. They're letting you have land. They used to
say land grant. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a land grant. They're saying, here's your land, dude. You're a separate people. Okay. And this is sacred land. So what comes out of the story? Well, the Indians leased the land to their people. This is sacred land. And they leased the land. They leased it probably to Americans who then used it for how they wanted to use it. And now the Indians want it back. They want to break the lease. Well, okay. So this is the kind of stuff when you start to dig into the facts, you start to see where the American people are under attack. Mm-hmm. They're being attacked at the most basic level. And you know, one way this comes through.
Yeah, this is, I was talking to a friend of mine whose nephew is going to college nearby, and he's given a video or a slideshow, I guess, if you will, before class begins. Remember that the university is built on stolen land and it was developed by slaves. Okay, how's this relevant to the classes they're taking? It's not. It's there to guilt, particularly the white students, and to agitate the black and colored students. It's there to create agitation. Cool. It's cheap grace anyway, because if this were true, then let's just bust up, to sell off the university and give it back to the, you know, give it back to the savages. Well, but no, they're not willing to do that.
They're not willing to do that, are they?
No.
They're not willing to do that. Notre Dame then should sell its land and give it back to the Potawatomi, right? But the Potawatomi get free tuition when they go to Notre Dame. Okay.
Yes. Yeah.
And Americans don't get free tuition because we're Americans.
And they don't pay income tax. And yeah.
And this is what the whole interracial justice thing was. This is about what the whole race issue, the civil rights issue was about. It was about guilt tripping white people in general and demoralizing us. That's what it was about.
Yeah, and stoking conflict by enforcing integration. Exactly. Yeah.
That's right. And it still created conflict between the nations. And that is not development under any sense of right thinking. That is not development. That is not right order in society. And that is not what the state is supposed to allow. But in America, the real power rests with the plutocracy, because the First Amendment takes all the power away from government, church, and all the culture is in the hands of this plutocracy. So that's what my book was about, how they got that power and how they make other societies like that. And the guys with the money control the deal.
Understood, the civil rights movement was not a protest movement. It was a proxy organization for the U.S. government itself and the oligarchs and the plutocrats that control the U.S. government. Because, from the standpoint, I guess from the vantage point or level of the South, it may be seen as a protest movement against the Southern governments and the local governments there. But it was a regime change operation on the part of the U.S. government and the oligarchs to destroy the what remained of federalism and state and local autonomy. And there was just a way to get to that by capitalizing or exploiting the racial issue and guilt tripping. Bam is promoting a certain narrative of things. The racial narrative of the civil rights movement is oppressed poor blacks and evil whites. That's the only narrative we're given, and it's not really respectable to consider some of the some of the complexities of the issue, like crime and how people got along. And you mentioned how some groups are backward and violent, and these are real problems that people were dealing with. They're trying to navigate at the time. And of course, this is already dismissed as just ignorant racism, by the way,
that's right,
who had no understanding of life in the South or wherever they're, a good example, you have people up in New England or in Minnesota lecturing the South on their ways without having any exposure to black people. It's like Uncle Tom's Cabin was written by a woman who never stepped foot in the South. But that Uncle Tom's Cabin is a narrative we're supposed to be given for that period in time. In fact, I was looking at a reading list of my kids' school, and Uncle Tom's Cabin is one of the books on the reading list. But that's agitprop. It's not reality. It's, neither was To Kill a Mockingbird, for that matter.
Right. They should it's agitprop. They should read The Black Gauntlet. The Black Gauntlet talked about life in the plantation. And the reality is that you had a situation this is a fight between nations. Okay, mm-hmm. There's this Black nation. It is a backward people. Now, parts of the Black nation have advanced. There's no doubt about that. Okay, and they have looked for ways to get in with the whites. Or the
integration
Americans.
Means they leave their Black nation and join the whites.
And integration.
So the Black nation never develops.
Means, right. Yeah. That's right. Integration means you reduce the legal strictures to letting the legal and the social strictures to letting Blacks go and live with Americans, while the Black communities decline. This is what Marcus Garvey talked about.
Yeah.
He said, the minute you allow integration, you're going to destroy the rest of the Black people. And you're going to, in the middle and the lower class, Blacks knew that and they didn't like it.
Well, oddly enough,
they didn't want Marcus Garvey. They didn't want the development of this nation.
Oddly enough, in Marcus Garvey's time, which is like 1910 to 1920, he was railroaded and deported.
Yeah, he was ultimately brought up on charges for, I believe, allegedly, I think he was convicted actually for embezzling money. But the Catholic Church has always recognized that there are backward peoples, and the Blacks are in large measure Black backward people. On Saturday, there was a game with the Tennessee State University, historically Black college or university, and the University of Notre Dame. That was on Saturday. Sunday night, there was a huge riot. 100 Blacks, according to the photos, and some few white people in there, were rioting at the Eddy Street Commons. There were gunshots. There was fighting. Eddy Street Commons, a very posh place, just across the street from the university, built at the request of the University of Notre Dame, mm-hmm. for the purpose of bringing in high-paying students, so they have a posh place to go and have coffee and do whatever, okay, and buy things or whatever. Okay, that happened on Sunday night. That's also just a few hundred yards from the Racklin Murphy Museum, $66 million museum. Okay, so this happens just, right outside the gates of Notre Dame, and nobody says anything at Notre Dame. Nobody says a thing at Notre Dame. And this is indicative of, like you said, the lower Blacks, the common Blacks, are not being developed as a nation. The Potawatomis also, and the Indians too, were not being developed as a nation. And then people say, oh, Dave, that's the official U.S. government's take on thing. That's really not the truth. Well, I said, okay. I said, the guy who really explained that whole thing was somebody by the name of Schoolcraft. And there's a town in Michigan that's named after him. Of course, they'll probably rename it after we do this show. But Schoolcraft was an interesting guy. Henry Rose Schoolcraft wrote A History of the Indian Tribes of the United States, Present Conditions and Prospects. His wife was the granddaughter of an Ojibwe war chief, and she taught him the language, the Ojibwe language. And then his second wife wrote the book, The Black Gauntlet, about the life on the plantation. So Schoolcraft wrote the authoritative history of the Indians in North America. And he said, these people aren't producing anything. The men hunt and war all day long. The women do all the manual labor. There's hardly anything under cultivation, okay? And so what you got is you got two kids per family. And that became the average because of all these other issues surrounding Indian life. They were just simply not employing the providential development of the land as God calls us to do, okay? And so people say, well, Dave, that was the official, that was the official government statement, and that's not true. I said, well, I tell you who else thought that Schoolcraft was right, and that was Father Baddon. He thought the same thing. He thought that the Indians were savages, and he used that word. And he was here in 1830 until about 1836, and he left. But he noted that the Indian men didn't work. They didn't till the ground. So he tilled the ground so that they would learn that it is something men can do too. So what you had was a situation here in northern Indiana where you had, according to this book that was published by the Indiana Historical Association in 1941, the letters of Father Benjamin Pettit, he talks about how there were only about 2,500 Indians in the northern third of the state of Indiana. And the Indian population had stayed pretty constant. They're about, it hadn't grown much, But the white population, the American population, because they're Americans or European descent with a certain culture, maybe Protestant, but has certain aspects to it. These are people, the Americans are people who through hard labor, tilled the ground, created, you know, these great crops, created industry and commerce. The American people grew from 6,500 in 1800 to what? Over 350,000 by 1830. This is how productive the Americans were. And we are called to make this land productive. And the Indians weren't doing that. Now here's where it gets really good. The Indians sat down with the Americans at a number of treaties, at a number of conferences, and they wrote treaties. And these meetings lasted several days to a couple weeks. And the American commissioners would not allow the Indians to have alcohol. And in 1834, they passed the law, America passed the law, saying no alcohol to Indians. If you give alcohol to Indians, you're going to jail, okay? So that's the way it is. And so the commissioners dealt with the Indians while they were sober, one-on-one, after days of discussion, and they bought the land, okay? They bought the land, they gave the Indians a lot of money, they gave them annuities, they gave them goods, they gave them a lot of things, okay? So this is what happened, and that the land that Indiana, that Notre Dame is sitting on, was purchased during one of these treaties. And Father Badden came along in 1832, and he bought 520 acres. He bought half of it from the state of Indiana, and then he bought the other half from two private individuals. One was a guy by the name of Merrill, who was the founder of the Bob's Merrill Publication Company. And then he built a log cabin, and he was going to turn it into an orphanage, but that didn't happen. So he gave it to the Bishop of Vincennes, who then made it the University of Notre Dame. Okay, so he bought this. Now Father Badden is an interesting character because the Americans liked him. He got along well with the Indians, and he got along well with the Americans. And he was at the Treaty of Tippecanoe, and he went out, which was in 1832, and he went out to Fort Wayne, and there he negotiated for the Americans with the Indians to buy land for the Wabash Canal. Okay, so here's Notre Dame saying, well, you know, you just thump our chests. Well, I mean, your own guy was part of that. So are you saying you're part of something evil? So this goes back to your point. If this is such a bad thing, then give the land back. Well, they're not going to do that. They're just going to shame us and use it as your prop to cause this problem in society, to destroy the nations by having them grind against each other, instead of going to the people with the resources and saying, why don't you guys have a sense of solidarity with your fellow countrymen? Which sense of solidarity has been slipping away for a long time? Samuel Huntington noted it in 2004. He said, we've got this cosmopolitan sense of people. They love humanity. They just don't like the people on this spit of ground where they're from. You know, it's that old thing, you know, of like, yeah, I love the human race. I just don't like a lot of individuals, you know. So this is what you have. You have this sense of cosmopolitanism rising up with the American elites, as Samuel Huntington talked about. And that has led to the American people being put under attack, and they're using the blacks to attack us, the Indians to attack, everybody's used to attack us, and the various different ideologies, LGBTQ, and all that other stuff to attack us. Now, what's interesting, though, is there's this Father Louis de Sel. And by the way, there's a band of Potawatomi here called the Pokagon Band. You know why they're still around? You know their history?
Offhand, no.
Okay. Because there was a chief called Pokagon, and he converted to the Catholic faith. Okay. And Father Frederick Reze from Germany converted.
So they learned how to read and write? He learned how to read and write.
He learned how to cultivate the land. And he learned how to create his little band. He took his family and his other followers. They went up to Dowagiac, Michigan. They bought land. They settled there. And now they still exist. But now they come down here and they dress up in Indian clothes and they shame the rest of us.
So they're in on the con.
They're in on it. Yeah, they're shaking everybody down. They're being used against the Americans, and their time's going to come too.
The same way Indians are used for liquor, for gambling licenses, right?
Yep, they have gambling casinos. Yeah. That's right.
That's very simple. In Canada, with the Kamloops hoax, where the Christian missionary schools were accused of Catholic ones of murdering hundreds, if not thousands, of children over several decades. There's supposed to be mass graves, and there was a big hullabaloo made in Canada about it. I think $2 billion were paid out in reparations. No bodies were found. Complete hoax. And the Pope apologized for it. Pope Francis apologized for these crimes that never happened. And he's also apologizing for evangelizing, heathen Indians. And why would a Pope apologize for evangelizing?
This is insane. Yes. This is absolutely insane.
The whole reason of the Catholic Church is to evangelize. And he's saying we shouldn't have evangelized these people.
Section 349 of the Catechism says that Christ is the eighth day of creation. So it's the creation of redemption from that. Okay. So we are supposed to evangelize. And the school of Salamanca, as I talk about in the articles, just came up with this idea of the law of nations and gave it the Christian twist to it, if you will, but gave it the Christian blessing and said, we are supposed to evangelize. We are, and the peoples are supposed to allow the priests to go to their lands and to convert people. That's not supposed to be hindered. We have an obligation to these people because they are backwards people.
Well, is that the point? I mean,
we're backwards.
The urgency behind conversion is acknowledging they need to be converted and developed. You have to acknowledge your backwardness, acknowledge your inequality.
You have an obligation to develop people materially and spiritually. The best spiritual development is with the Catholic faith. That's how you do it. And the church has got that obligation. There's no sense for us to apologize. He apologized about something else, about the indigenous peoples of Latin America. And the reality is that the right of discovery was not used to claim that land. There were a number of other reasons. There were alliances that the conquistadores made to fight the Indian, the various Indians who were oppressing other people.
Well, the Aztecs were the Aztecs were a satanic empire. I mean,
and Christians and nations have an obligation to go into countries to stop those kind of abuses. Those kind of abuses against the natural order or to protect people from destruction. And if you look at the syllabus of errors, you look at point number 62, where Pius IX says this idea that intervention is wrong is itself wrong, because what the modernists were teaching and what the liberal regime was teaching in the 1800s was, well, no, you can't go into other countries. Each country is responsible for its own. This is how the Law of Nations, which started out in such a good form with the School of Salamanca, was corrupted by guys like Grotius, De Vitale, and others. And that is the truncated Law of Nations that the United States came to accept and to understand. However, the American people and the American government still had this idea of material development, and they still advance this idea of material development against these backward peoples. And they tried to help these backward peoples, but the spiritual side was missing. The big thing was Chief Menominee. Father Louis de Sales came in and he converted Menominee. And Louis de Sales said, you know, it looks like they're trying to remove you from this land and to destroy your nation. And the American commissioner said, get the hell out of here. What you have to understand is the Americans by the 1830s, all those guys in positions of authority, to include the president, who was Andrew Jackson, had fought the Indians. They were all veterans of Indian wars. They had fought the British, and they knew the brutality of this war, and they knew how difficult it was to work with Indians and to try to integrate them. They also knew the Indians were being slowly destroyed. And so they offered a way to preserve these people by giving them reservations, by giving them lands, giving them annuities, paying them for their property. And a lot of the people who negotiated those deals were Indians themselves, okay? Traders, T-R-A-D-E-R-S, traders who were able to make money from the deal and move that way. What I'm saying is something called the Law of Nations. This gives us the way forward. We are born into a people on a piece of dirt, and we are good, and that has got a culture, and we must not lose sight of that. So when they say white people, they say Americans. So I'm saying, Americans, come into the Catholic Church. Be in the Catholic Church. Let's perfect our culture even more. and I say to blacks or Negroes or African Americans, whatever their name is this week, come into the Catholic Church, improve and better your people. Let's stop this warfare. We have a common enemy, okay? The lovers of money, that's our common enemy. These are the people that have no loyalty to us. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, and you said they're cosmopolitan, they're globalist, they're neoliberal, whatever you want to, you know, what term to apply to them. Rootless cosmopolitans, I think what Stalin called them.
Yeah, I think you're right.
The idea is that they can leverage humanity against one another. And you know, a good example is mass immigration or migration or illegal immigration is a part of that. The wave of migration to Europe to break down national identity, to sow discord and create disorder in those societies, to break up those nations that have still have some ethno basis. And of course, America too has, so the ethnogenesis occurred in the United States, where there was the American, this, the core American, if you will, the idea of the American nation state based on certain ideals that were passed down from Americans, and they're trying to flood the country from, you know, from people from all over the world at such a rate where the country and nation will dissolve because the institutions that define America will no longer be supported. And it's not really those institutions, those laws aren't really being supported by the current regime that's in power. It's an alien regime at this point because it serves the interest of big money, big capital and finance. And that's all about, again, destroying the middle class. The very things that you talk about when you talk about forming nations and developing, allowing peoples to develop, is that becomes a stumbling block to globalism, because as people develop skills and culture, these things, they start to develop economic interests that can compete with the oligarchs, and they can press those rights, they can challenge, and they can make demands. They can demand that the wealth, you know, the goods of this world are distributed properly through their productivity. But the model is to destroy that capacity for productivity and put everyone on welfare. And then kill them off. I mean, good example is what happened with the Guaranis, with the Jesuits, you know, in the 17th century, when that program was shut down in favor of slavery, because they were developing too fast. They were becoming literate and productive. They were actually developing, finished manufacturing, because I think violins, I think they developed for export. That's an economic model that the Freemasons at the time, who were, had insinuated themselves in the Spanish and I think the Portuguese governments, you know, got the church, unfortunately, to shut that, you know, to shut down the Jesuit reductions in Paraguay, you know. And the rest, as they say, is history. The slave model was the, you know, the slave or capitalist model was imposed. You know, the same thing with the importation of chattel slavery into the United States, the exploitation. Not only did it exploit the slaves, although I think it did materially develop them more, they did benefit materially from it because the life was that much better in the United States. That's not a justification, just an observation. But it lowered the wages for Americans. It was a conspiracy to lower wages for white Americans, because they didn't want to pay the higher wages. They wanted short-term profits, and to hell, they just simply didn't care about what type of social problems it created. You know, there was someone else, you know, I guess there was a problem for future generations to worry about and to be exploited, as we've seen how the racial issue has been exploited historically by, you know, financial interests. And it continues to this day, right? And we see it to this day. It's constant agitation by big media, by commercial, you know, by industry, by government, constant agitation. No effort is made to address the real problems like crime, illegitimacy, immorality, and violence in these communities. At the same time, the white people, who simply think if they pay their taxes and follow, you know, play by the rules, they'll be left alone. That isn't the case anymore. They're obviously, they've been targeted, and that's, you know, the situation as it is today. There is a war on white people, white Americans. There's a war on all ethnic whites throughout the world. Because like, I think because ethnic whites, this is the West. It's Christendom. It's the Occident. It's the way of life. And I think the oligarchs who have a model for the future that doesn't want to see an energetic, educated middle class, again, that has the consciousness and, more importantly, the agency to make demands and press their interest, you know.
Well, the ruling classes want the destruction of the nations, and they want to create a new nation. And while I know people, we have to get away from white and black. I think we have to go back to American and Negro. Mm-hmm. This is what Leo XIII talked about. And the Negroes are known as blacks, and white people are Americans. Mm-hmm. This is our ethnic identity. The reality is, like John Jay said in Federalist 2, we are all of the same ancestry, similar religion, When you say you're the same ancestry, the same blood, the same race, you're saying you have a similar history. You're talking about the ancestry came from Europe or from one country or another, but this is who we are. And Americans are under attack. And there is just no, I hear it every other day, like I said. Every other day, people are saying, we're scared. We're scared for our kids. Well, this is not right order, okay? This is disorder. And the state is supposed to stop this disorder. The state is supposed to step in and disperse the wealth and grow the nations and benefit the nations in accordance with the fundamental rights, which is, you know, right to have kids, culture, and a good living. Those are the fundamental rights that you have to have. And that's what the state has got to provide. That is something that is morally required. And all the business books, you're going to see where they say the bigger the population, the more diffuse the wealth. Well, they don't want that. You know, the Bezoses of the world don't want that. Mm-hmm. You know, they want it concentrated. They want to control that wealth. And that's what technology does. That's what AI can potentially do. It's going to concentrate all of this wealth. And it's going to make it harder and harder for people to live. And so if we're fighting each other, blaming each other, we don't see who's pulling the strings.
Yeah.
And this is the struggle. Well, it's the Americans are great people. We're great people. We did great things.
It's an oligarchy. It's a rigged system. And they call it freedom. They call it competition. And they invoke the sanctity of property after they steal everything. It's kind of like the Protestant Reformation. Right.
Right. It's the sanctity of private property.
The English Reformation, where they seized all the property, then declared property sacrosanct.
It's sacrosanct. That's correct.
Yeah. And the rich got rich, the poor got poorer. And that's
right. Yeah. And they used that property to go and explore the new world. That's what they did. And they wanted to make more money. And so the church says, no, all the property, you have a right to property. It's not absolute.
Well, who are the governing authorities now? Is it states? Or is it corporations?
Well, I think it's a combination of corporations. I think you're talking about the BlackRocks, the private venture capital firms. I mean, you got the top 10 venture capital firms. They got $50 trillion under management.
Yeah,
I mean, ESG, that's real money.
They talk about ESG, environmental social governance.
That's right.
Using the control of these, the assets they control to bend society to their will, to Larry Fink's will and what he thinks is proper, who elected him. And he openly talked about, there's a video a few years ago, he was at some sort of meeting and he's talking about how, you know, it's BlackRock and how he is taking the responsibility to force change on people. You know, people won't want to accept it, but our job is to force them to change. Well, who are you? And he used an interesting term. He referred to, you know, how the citizens of BlackRock have certain obligations to force change. Of course, the change is degeneracy, transgenderism, these things. But
the citizens is the sterilization of the earth.
Exactly.
And it is the destruction of the nations. It is the destruction of God's creation that goes directly against what the Catholic Church has always taught in its law of nations theology.
Interesting enough, he used the term citizens of BlackRock. I would think they're employees of Black, mere employees of BlackRock. Why would you use the term citizens of BlackRock? That's an odd term for a company, don't you think? I mean, sometimes people refer to their company as family. You know, we're the family. That's sort of just to make everyone feel nice, warm, and fuzzy about who they're
because
working
anybody
for.
Can get in BlackRock. Like,
but a citizens of BlackRock?
Citizen is an ideological construct.
Yes.
Yeah, anybody can come into BlackRock. Anybody can be a BlackRock person, but not everybody can belong to the American nation.
Yeah, but outfits like BlackRock and Amazon, they're tapped into the Federal Reserve System, cheap credit. Amazon has huge contracts with the CIA that they leverage that profit to dominate the market, you know, become even bigger. They profit off the taxpayer subsidized networks, transportation systems, roads, these things. And so it's very simple. What you could do is you could make these companies, on condition of their corporate charter, make them swear an oath to uphold, defend the Constitution of the United States, as like the First Amendment, so they couldn't engage in things like, you know, like censorship and call, you know, deplatform people and say, well, it's, you know, my private company, nothing you can do about it. You know,
you have to put something in the Constitution that is recognizing certain foundational concepts. And what that has to be is some kind of identification with American culture and the recognition that there are other nations. So there has to be a recognition of the need for the development, the proper development of nations. That has to be in the Constitution. That has to be written in there as a minimum, because otherwise then Katie barred the door. And you have to take a look at the definition of these terms as they have been understood in American history and as they've been understood by humanity, because the law of nations is about human history. It's about the understanding of things like nations and states, the right understanding of those things, not the wrong understanding, but the right understanding. So that has to be in the Constitution. You see something like that in countries like Hungary and Russia. You see this deference to a Russian people, this deference to a culture. All peoples to have right culture. I think Costa Rica has language to that effect in their constitution. Whether they honor it or not, that's another issue, okay? But that has to be in the constitution. And the corporations, which are largely sanctioned or approved at state level, have got to be held account mm-hmm. to that, because they become these not only national actors, but global actors. So yeah, there has to be some sense of it.
The privileges of the privilege law that they operate under is granted to them by the state. And they can only prosper because of the state and the people that live under the state, and meaning that they're, therefore they have some obligation. It used to be that corporate charters were limited. I think I understand they were like a defined purpose for a period of time, like 10 years to build a road, to build a railroad or internal improvements. And it served that function. That was that corporate charter. Since the 70s or 80s, we've had corporate personhood and this idea that corporations existing in perpetuity. And from what I understand, that's a modification of that, of the law, of corporate law. And now we have a corporation with limited liability, with corporate personhood. That's sort of a recipe for for psychopathy, for psychopathic behavior on the part of that corporation. And collectively, that corporation act like a psychopath, and the people that work for that corporation will, in a way, become psychopaths if they're not already.
Well, that's why Klaus Schwab came along to talk about stakeholders. He saw the problem you're talking about, and he's got a way to fix it, Tim.
Stakeholders.
It's stakeholders. We're stakeholders. We're going to be holding the stake as they drive it through our hearts.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm a stakeholder. Okay, hold that stake. We got to hammer it in a little better. Yeah, okay. So, right. So what you have with all the constitutions in this country is you have no mention of a people, of a culture. You may have mention of God, you may have mention of morality, but you know, these terms are subject to the fluctuation. So, you know, what you have in other countries and other places is this idea of a people. Now, what the value of what this court has done and why they're going after Thomas and Scalia and others so hard is because these guys are writing decisions that point us back to 1776, when we still had the common law in large mm-hmm. measure in our country, which was local law, ecclesiastical law, Roman law. It was kind of all Western law. It had some Protestant stuff thrown in there, but it still had certain basic ways to keep society together. And one of those was the Ten Commandments, respecting the Ten Commandments. And that's why the state of Texas went recently and posted the Ten Commandments, because they know that's the natural law and that's the basis for keeping the people together. And when you put that together, you're going to have different nations. You're going to have the American nation. You're going to have the Negro nation. You're going to have the Latin nation. And these all nations are what we are born into, because that's also our heritage. It has aspects of DNA, and DNA does affect how we act. Mm-hmm. It does affect, to a degree, what we do. If DNA wasn't important, maybe there are 58 genders. Maybe there really are. If DNA is not, but DNA is important. It is an important factor, okay? And it's got to be looked at. So treat everybody equally. Well, you have to take a look at their situation. You have to treat them justly. Justly. Not necessarily equally, but justly, with charity. And that is called solidarity. And that's what you got to have And that is what the leadership, the socioeconomic elites do not have. And that's why the socioeconomic elites have got to be changed. And it has to be in the order of patriotism. And that patriotism has to be grounded in this idea of the nations on a piece of dirt, multiple nations under it. Other countries have done this all throughout history. Now, certain things would have to be curtailed. Yeah. You know, you gotta have to cut back on all this crap in the movies and all this stuff that goes out there, pornography, you know, that has to all get cut back.
But wasn't this understood as maintaining a moral order and there are institutions in place, both legal and also customary, to restrict these things, right?
It was. The states did have that. And beginning in 1925, that was slowly peeled back. And the big one was 1952 with the Miracle Baby case, where the movie came out, and I think it was New York, said, you're not going to show this movie. It's blasphemous. Oh, they went to court. And of course, they got New York's, you know, decency laws basically thrown out. Yeah, that was a huge decision. I think that was Wilson versus Burstyn, 1952. That was a huge decision. It's called the Miracle Baby case because that was the name of the movie. It has something to do with a, you know, this miraculous birth, and it was a mocking of the Virgin Mary. And
okay, so
That was a huge decision. While we had, you may have had the production code, but the states lost control to govern their morals. Okay, and that is the breakdown of nations right there. That destroyed nation, not just the American nation, but also the Negro nation. It's going to affect every nation.
Yep. Well, I think we covered it.
I think we did.
Can you cite the articles that we're talking about here?
Yeah, excuse me. I'm losing my voice. And
one you've published, one you haven't published yet, right?
Yeah, excuse me. It's on the American Proposition website. The part one, the land was made for you and me, or the Crocs Croc, part one. And then this land was made for you or me, or the Crocs Croc, part two is coming up. The interracial problem is from July.
Mm-hmm.
And we talk about the law of nations as a way to go forward for Blacks or Negroes, Americans, Latins, every nation of people in this country. It's a way to go forward. It's a way to affect fundamental change that makes sense, and that will, if it doesn't change the elites, it removes the elites.
Well, isn't this the ultimate celebration of diversity?
Absolutely, it is.
Instead of an amalgamation of everyone, this one big gray globalist blob.
Well, they're creating a new race, a new people. Yes. That's what they're doing. It's a new nation that has no memory and no soul, and that's going to be used to just simply serve the powers of the day. That's all it is. These people have no history. We look. If you're white and you're Christian and you're from the United States, you're an American, okay? Mm-hmm. You're an American and you got a great history. We got a great history. We settled this land. We made it productive. We got along. Our leadership may have been bad at different times. I'm not saying they were all great. And we got some structural issues that have caused some problems. But we've also done a lot of good things, and we've gotten along with each other, whether you like it or not.
Especially relative to the rest of the world, for Pete's sake.
We have. Whether you like it or not, segregation, the laws that came about as after the Civil War actually did ensure social peace in society.
Mm-hmm.
And the church has recognized that that's a good, that's a value. Even Epstein writes, it says, you know, racial segregation is okay and it's approved by the church if it allows for social peace, but it still allows some sociability between the different groups. And, you know, if you read back in the 40s and 50s, all the Catholic prelates accepted that. They simply accepted it. It kept peace. And so they went and they talked to the Blacks or the Negroes as one people, and, you know, the whites as another people, the Americans as another people. And so that's what they did. They worked that, and they accepted that. And if you want to, you know, I know this might be a little different, but if you want to look back on church history and see where the church approved segregation of people, you just have to look at Pope Eugene IV, right? You know, Dumdum ad nostrum audientium, is that it? That was the papal bull that said, put the Jews in the ghettos, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well,
it's... Again, why
segregated them?
Why is it
partly for their protection? partly for their protection,
yeah,
partly for the protection of others. And the American leadership under Andrew Jackson and James Monroe understood that the Indians were going to be exterminated if they didn't put them on reservations.
Well, they were dealing with the way the world is, not the way some, perhaps some utopian visionary wanted it to be.
That's
based
right.
on and some they, liberal, you know, liberal idea of what's good. And a lot of this is, right. you know, presupposes that the based on liberal presuppositions, which aren't, may not be, you know, the final analysis, the best way to order society.
But they also did not have, right. They also did not have the Catholic religion established, mm-hmm. which would have allowed them to bridge these gulfs and bring harmony between these people with a common religion. They couldn't go out there like the Spanish conquistadors and say, hey, you know, we're going to convert you too. So they converted people, right? This is a good point of Moynihan's 1965 report. Okay, I think it was deficient in many ways, what Daniel Patrick Moynihan wrote. But one thing he wrote that was actually very good is he said, the slavery in Brazil was different from the slavery here because you had a Catholic country. And they integrated those people. They built the family in those people. They made them a part of the society. They bridged that gap, even though they had different ancestors, okay, from the Portuguese. They were able to bridge that gap with a common religion and to civilize them with that religion. Now, a lot of what, and that's Catholicism, and that was the defect in the American organization here. But, you know, it's a Protestant country, you know, mm-hmm. and they did the best they could, you know. So, but what you all, another problem of Moynihan, while we're on the topic of Moynihan, he talks about the collapse of the Black family. But then he says some Black families really are better than American families. Well, wait a minute. If slavery destroyed the Black family, how can some be better than American families? So that never quite made sense to me, his whole approach. I think what he was dealing with is he had the urban Blacks who just, they collapsed. Their society collapsed. There was nobody able to go in there to basically help this backwards people. And the church has always recognized backwards people, whether they be backwards materially or morally or spiritually. And you say that now, we're probably going to get in trouble.
Well, yeah, I mean, by the
90s, this conversation.
Yeah, by the 1960s, the racial narrative was you'd be accused of, you know, if I think Moynihan was accused of blaming the victim then. But if you acknowledge any responsibility on the part and the need, the acknowledgement of backwardness and inequality based on the, you know, basically the temperament or culture that you're dealing with, you're accused of, you know, white supremacy, although it's obvious for you all to see because the constant problems and claims for reparations or programs and these things is their admission that they need to be that they need to be administered or handled in some way or another. The question is that going to be done in a Catholic way, which I think bears fruit, whereas the other way, the welfare state system that which the which was adopted in the 1960s has just led to, you know, it's been a disaster. All the moral hazards, you know, that it involved, and not to mention the whole milieu of the 60s with sexual revolution and sexual liberation and the whole, you know, the course that culture took in that time frame wasn't conducive to an ordered society, an ordered morality, which ultimately you need to maintain law and order in society. You can't have people with basically in the 1960s you had popular culture, you had government, you had institutions promoting individual or internal disorder on the part of individuals in the name of liberation and freedom. Well, if you promote internal disorder, you're going to get public disorder. And that's what we have. That's what we continue to have, you know?
Yeah, I think that's a very, very big factor.
You know, but the problem is then you go against the spirit of the age, you know, right?
Yeah, I think, you know, when you start talking morality, people will sometimes glaze over. But if you talk about the fact we're all born to parents who were born to parents,
mm-hmm.
they were all born in a nation, you know, as Epstein defines, we're all born in a nation, a family, a group of people on a piece of dirt. Okay. And that's what makes us Americans. The first person who was born in Virginia in what, 1610, was at Virginia Dare. She was an American. When Benjamin Franklin went over to England in 1724 for his apprentice, they called him an American. Mm-hmm. Well, that was the identity at the time. That's who we are. We are Americans. We are, this is our land. These are our people. And this is good. This is a good thing. And if you just say it's DNA, then you miss the entire point. So we're born into nations. We are the American people. I'm not going to say white anymore. We're the American people. And we can call them the Negro Nation or the Black Nation or the Afro Nation, but it's going to be the American Nation and the Black Nation and the Latin Nation and whoever else. But we're part of a nation. We're part of a, there's some nations, I get that, but we are part of a nation. And that's good. And God wants nations. That's part of his plan. And the church has always taught that. There's always going to be nations. But the plutocrats want to destroy nations. They want to make the land infertile. That's why they're cutting down trees to put solar farms. That's insane. You know, that's why they're doing that stuff. Because they hate creation.
They're killing whales to create, the wind turbines, which are...
yeah. Right, that's right.
Yeah, and that's why they want to destroy agriculture and make everyone eat the bugs and eat lab grown meat, you know.
That's right, and so this idea of nationhood will go against this idea of individualism, but you have to understand this idea of the liberal order where it came from, okay, and you have to understand that it is based on an idea of an individual as an economic unit. And you have to take that and you have to say, okay, well, maybe the liberal order allowed for a lot of production, but it's not enough. We need to understand we are in a nation and we have to protect these people. And this society knew that. Going back to our beginning, the Americans knew that. And it was strengthened in the 1870s. And I think you can say the KKK was a reaction to the threats to this nation. It was lower and middle class Americans for the most part who were opposed to threats of their way of life or what they perceived to be threats. Now, it was also used. I can understand that. They also had some bad actors who were leading it. And there was also the potential for it to be manipulated. But that's what you've always had in this country. But we have to understand we're born to parents and they're born to somebody else on this land. That's my point. And that's all Catholic. And that is the Catholic law of nations.
And you can't choose your parents.
You can't choose your parents. No, you're right. But if you're Catholic or you're Christian, you have a duty to choose rightly. And you have a duty to spread these ideas.
Well, you're abridging my individual rights when you do that. So,
yeah, I know. I know.
Okay, David, thanks so much.
All right. Thanks a lot, Tim.
You have a good evening. I'll post this soon.
Okay. Let's chat just a little bit at the end.
Sure. Okay. That's of course, that's David Wim Hof. His website is The American Proposition, the author of John Courtney Murray, Time Life, The American Proposition. I personally think one of the most important books written in the past, at least in my lifetime. So I'll let you go. Good night then.
Good night, Tim. Thank you very much. Bye-bye. You're very kind.